Well, let's go ahead and get going. I don't know where everybody is, but I hope they're okay. I know Bobby's still running around here somewhere, but anyway, so where we are in Isaiah is chapter 40, and what it is sort of a changeover from the previous chapters. So the previous few chapters were this historical story about, what happened in and around the time of the siege of Jerusalem. Before that was sort of the build up, and now this is sort of the aftermath. So you've got kind of three sections, basically. Now they're all divided into subsections, but 40, like for instance, Andy was just talking about how in his notes end around Isaiah 39. And the reason is that the rest of Isaiah is very much prophetic and future, as opposed to the prophecies before the siege of Jerusalem saying, hey, this is what we need to do. This is the aftermath of that. Now, the way that this that things go from here on is talking about Israel, but also a whole lot of stuff that is very future and broad and useful for the whole world. So most of the time when you see quotes from Isaiah on somebody's wall or somebody mentions them from the pulpit, they're usually in 40 to 66 in that range. Look, Isaiah 41, Isaiah 45, Isaiah 54, right? There are all these famous quotes and famous things that we talk about all the time. They're almost all from this next section because this is when he really gets serious about the future and starts talking about, for instance, the Messiah that's coming. Now, some of the interesting things that are in this last section, and it's a big section. It's not a small section. It's, almost half the book or whatever. So it's not just like afterthoughts or anything like that. It's very big. It's a very big, important part of the whole book. But it deals with some things, and he'll mention things that seem impossible. Because he talks about, for instance, Cyrus the Great. Now, Cyrus the Great's born around 600 and ruling into, basically all through the 500s, at least the first half of the 500s, and is the person who sends everybody back to Jerusalem, the people that have been captured and taken to Babylon. Well, we're pretty sure that Isaiah didn't live to be 250 or 300 years old, right? That kind of ended along, basically Moses' time frame is when the really long lives started ending. We go back before that, we get some pretty long lives, but we think Isaiah had a pretty normal run, 100-ish years, maybe slightly longer, but something like that. So when he's talking about things in the future, if it's poetic and general, nobody has a problem with it. But when he starts naming names, people, scholars start to go, well, how did he know Cyrus's name? Well, how did he know anything? But that debate begins where did more than one person write Isaiah? Did he have people after him that picked it up and kept going? Et cetera. So, thank you, Bobby. But the thing is that before this, where people are comfortable with Isaiah being the author, and it doesn't matter, by the way. We don't care who Psalms who wrote Psalms. It could be 12 guys that wrote Psalms. Psalms are awesome. We learn from them. They're from God for us. So it doesn't matter if there's another person doing it, but it's just interesting that scholars talk about it. And one of the things that it does, for the most part, that use of that argument is to undermine the Bible. For the most part, that's the reason for it. Because nobody could really know all this. Like Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a great guy, for the most part. He had some problems, but for the most part, he was a great guy. Definitely a good president. Definitely did things that we needed to have done. I wouldn't be an American without Thomas Jefferson, because I'm from Louisiana. So, or technically, I guess I'm originally from North Carolina, so I'd probably still be American. But anyway, the point is that he loved Jesus as a philosopher, as somebody that you would live your life based on and be guided by, but didn't believe in miracles. So he had taken the Bible and kind of cut out the miracles and made his Thomas Jefferson Bible, which is the whole story of Jesus without any miracles, which is a fascinating story. I don't know what you do with Jesus without miracles, but that's an example of how people want to approach it. People don't have a big problem with Jesus existing, and they don't have a big problem with Jesus existing like Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. He was this amazing leader, had all these great philosophies, and he was a cool guy, but that's not the deal. Jesus was not a cool guy. He was not, because either we got like Pastor Todd says whenever he does one of these talks, Jesus has to be one of three things, because he claims to be the Son of God, right? And he does all these things, which means he has to either be a madman, or he has to be a liar. He has to be crazy and think he's the Son of God and not be, or he has to be a liar where he knows he's not. He's making all these things up, which means he's a really good magician. Really good magician. That Lazarus thing, that was like, wow, way to distract the audience. Or he's the Son of God, right? So what he is not is a cool guy, because if he wasn't the Son of God and he said all that stuff, then he is not a cool guy. So you don't have that. Hey, he's just a really great philosopher human with nothing else involved. You don't have that option. But anyway. A lot of times people try to undermine those things. And one of those things is Isaiah calling out Cyrus by name. Because give or take, he would be dead, give or take, 100 years before Cyrus. Maybe 50 years, but before Cyrus is even born. Before Babylon is even a kingdom, Isaiah would probably be done. Before, you know, Babylon ever arrives and takes anybody away. Think about it like this. The whole point of Isaiah is that a great giant enemy empire comes upon Jerusalem. They can absolutely not be stopped. And then God just stops them. In a single night, bang, everybody's dead, everybody go home. And that is just earth-shatteringly cool and interesting, and it's a game changer for everyone alive during that time. If you were not a believer, you were after that. I mean, everything just changed. Babylon is going to come and sack Jerusalem. It's a whole different deal. And there's not going to be an Isaiah talking about how, there is, but he's not going to be listened to. There's not going to be a Hezekiah. They're going to get taken away. That's a very strange thing. So for Isaiah to know that would be fascinating, because he would be like, okay, God did it this time in such a giant way. Why would he not do it next time? And the answer is Isaiah and Hezekiah. The answer is the obedience of the people. Imagine that within 100 years, God does this 185,000 dead people, Assyrian army leaving thing. And then everybody forgets about it and goes about their business. I mean, that would be pretty infuriating. I can't speak for God. God's the same all the time. His ways are not my ways. But that would be pretty infuriating. If you had given somebody the ultimate proof. And then a generation or two later, they're like, did that really happen? Because I'm pretty sure that's like a legend. And then some weird old guy with a cane talking about, no, I walked out there. We had to get rid of the bodies. They were stinking. It was nuts. And you're like, okay. And then a generation after that, though, there's no old guys. And, you know, you're like, eh, probably, maybe it was 1800 or something. It wasn't like 185,000. A lot of, you know, I don't know. But they lose faith pretty much across the board, which typically is leadership-based. It's from the top down. When they had Hezekiah and Isaiah, it held everybody together. When they don't have the leadership and the kings are not there, so that's just very strange. But then I notice Isaiah jumps to Cyrus. Now, Cyrus is later. Cyrus is after Nebuchadnezzar. He's after Daniel in Lion's Den. Later on, after the Babylonians, the Persians come, Medes and Persians. Cyrus is a Persian. The Persian Empire is founded, which is going to last several hundred years. It's going to be taken out by Alexander between the two testaments, okay? And Cyrus is the one that sends them back. And the reason he talks about Cyrus is that Cyrus is being used by God specifically, which is another crazy story, because Cyrus thinks his god, Marduk, is talking to him, and it's not. That's crazy. I don't even know what God was doing or why. I can't even figure it out. But then he, like, sends them back. But the reason I know that this is all real is not because of the name of Cyrus. It's what everybody talks about. That's coming up in a couple chapters. But I want to forecast all the way to the very end of Isaiah. And I just want to show you one thing to keep in the back of our heads. All the way at the end, we go all the way to 66. And go to 66:18. Now, the reason I'm pointing out 66:18, which is a long time from now in this class, okay? The reason I'm pointing out 66:18 is because that's the next prose historical section. So there is none between from 40 to 66. It's all poetry and prophecy, okay? There's very little in the way of the prose style writing that we've had the last few chapters. There's almost none of that anywhere. Little snippets, basically none of that. But look at what he says. And this is not really talked about much. But just look at what this says real fast. So this is God speaking at the very end of Isaiah. Okay. He's talking about, I know their works and their thoughts. And I will gather all nations and tongues. They shall come and see my glory. I will set a sign among them. And those of them who escape, I will send to the nations. And he mentions by name Tarshish. And he talks about Tubal and Javan and all of this. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles, or they shall bring red. Now, the reason I pointed that out is he's talking about Tarshish. And he's talking the city of Tarshish. And he's talking about spreading his glory to the Gentiles. Now, this is in Isaiah. This is the first of the major prophets in the Old Testament. This is so long ago. It's crazy. But when he talks about Cyrus, that's pretty amazing, because he's talking about a leader that comes into power 50, 100 years after he's dead, right? But this is talking about a city, the city of Tarshish, and sending out people to the Gentiles. And everybody knows that Paul is from Tarshish. He's the number one character in the Bible and in the history of the world in the city of Tarshish. And it's talking about bringing it out to the Gentiles. No way in a million years would the ancient Hebrew scriptures be talking about bringing anything to Gentiles. It doesn't make any sense. Unless you're looking all the way to Paul. from Isaiah, which is a whole lot further than Cyrus and a whole lot crazier. Coming up with the idea that maybe they'll be taken away is one thing. Coming up with the idea that they might be coming back is another thing. But mentioning at the very end of the, one of the most prophetic and important books ever written in the history of the world, at the very end of it, mentioning all the way to somebody from Tarshish, or and multiple other people are mentioned, but and that's a hint. He doesn't name Paul by name. Of course, he can't name Paul by name because Paul's going to have two names, and he won't even be Paul when he's born in Tarshish. He'll be Saul. So that name change is another whole thing. Saul is a big, powerful name, and Paul is a very diminutive, small name, and he's basically saying, I was this big, powerful guy, and I was Saul, but now I'm Paul. I'm this little, weak, meek guy in the sight of God, right? Like in my understanding of who I am. Anyway, I had to take us all the way to the end to show you that he gets a whole lot crazier than Cyrus in my mind. In my mind, he mentions Paul, and he mentions people in places that don't even really, are not really important at all. Maybe don't even exist yet. And then going out to the Gentiles and taking all this information, like he's talking about Acts 700 years earlier, 800 years earlier. I mean, it's crazy. Anyway, I believe that it's all one wackadoo guy named Isaiah, who is the right-hand man of God. And he is right there, and he can see it all. And I don't know how he sees it, or if God just says, write this down. Like I said, I don't know how he does it. But I think he does. I think he knows. I don't know if he feels it or hears it or sees it, but I think he knows about Acts. I think he knows that there's going to be a time, there's a Messiah is going to come, and they're going to torture and kill him, and he's going to rise again. He's going to empower a bunch of people to go out into the world, and the whole world, all nations and tongues, are going to be saved. And he's thinking that in a tiny Jewish enclave inside of a temple inside of Jerusalem. And no one's ever mentioned that in all of history, that they might be anything but this group of people. In fact, they specifically don't want to go out. Here's the trick. Every time they have a problem is because they go out. Every time something breaks down, like the entire kingdom with Solomon, every time it breaks down is because you let outsiders in. The one thing you don't want to do is go out anywhere and hang out with any Gentiles. That's like rule number one. They can't even come in your house. You can't even go in their house. How are you going to explain anything to them if they can't come to the temple, right? They can't be a priest. So somehow he knows that there's an answer, which blows my mind, because there's only one answer. There's only one way to get from where Isaiah is sitting in a temple and where we're sitting, and that's Jesus. So he has to fully understand how that works. And, you know, most modern leaders don't fully understand how that works. But he's got a way in his head that this is all going to be possible to bring that out. So anyway, that's what 40 to 66 is about, is the evolution from here we are as a people in this city. Here the enemy comes to attack us. Here we are believing and trusting in God, and here he is defending us and protecting us and lifting us up. And this is a wonderful story. Now what next? And he has an answer. Here's what's next. This and this and this and this forever and ever. I mean, and I'm sure everybody just, I don't know what they're doing at this point. They had to trust him because he already told them what was going to happen, and then it happened. So that tends to get people's trust. Of course, once he passes away and all those people that have heard him and were there pass away, what happens? So anyway, that's what 40 is. That's what we're jumping into, because he's talking about the time frame first, about the comfort, and that comes from, you know, after this whole thing has happened. And then we're moving into what I think is the first major future section, which is 40 verse 3, the voice of one crying in the wilderness. It's poetic how he's writing it. But I think our first, or one of our first big hits of a non-Messiah character in the future that he can't possibly know anything about is John the Baptist. And I think, I don't know if this is a symbol. And God can do what he does. So I don't know which is first, the chicken or the egg. In other words, does Isaiah write about a voice crying out in the wilderness and John the Baptist read that and go, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be the voice. Let me get in the wilderness and cry out. Let me eat locusts and honey and try to make straight the path for the Lord. Or does he do that and Isaiah's talking about what he's going to do? I don't know which is first, the chicken or the egg, right? And I don't think it much matters because we have plenty of chickens and plenty of eggs. But it's just fascinating because it's exactly what we pick up when we pick up with John the Baptist. And he's going to make straight the road. Okay, there's a highway. Basically, this we've read this stuff a million times and heard this stuff a million times because of how important it is. In other words, there has to be a road. There has to be a way to God, to understand God. And there has to be somebody to show you that way. And unfortunately, it's a wilderness and a jungle out here. And it's not easy. So somebody needs to come and make a path. And those are people like John the Baptist, or in modern times, it'd be somebody like Billy Graham or Pastor Todd. This is somebody that's trying to hack down bushes to make a path so that we can get on the right road, right? Of course, the road itself is Jesus. But having a way, you know, God has to make a way through this nonsense. Like if you're a Ukrainian believer right now, you're on your knees. God has got to make a way. You can't do anything. You'll try whatever you can physically to do. But God has to make a way. And so he'll send people and do things and arrange things. He'll make crooked places straight, rough places smooth. And all the time he's doing that, his glory is being revealed, making a way. So when he makes a way through that crazy time of your life, or makes a way, no matter how weird the political situation is in America or how full of fear people are about whatever, he makes a way. So we pick up in 46 when a voice says, cry out. And he said, what shall I cry? And then it was, all flesh is grass, all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers and the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades. And the word of our God stands forever. So this is a perspective. And I don't know if he's preaching this. In my head, Isaiah's preaching to a group of people, probably all the people gathered in the temple, probably after this whole thing has happened. I don't know if that's true. He could just be writing it down. But the reason he's setting a tone like that is that even though this great thing has happened, that is temporary. There's going to be a lot of things coming and going. There's going to be a lot of problems coming at people. There's going to be a lot of wonderful times. There's going to be a lot of scary times. But the word of God stands forever. There is no, you know, him hawing around, changing his mind, coming from God. So in 9, O Zion, you who bring good tidings, get up into the high mountain, O Jerusalem. You will bring good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God shall come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him, and he will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and gently lead those who are with the young, or with young. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and whom instructed him and taught him the path to justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? So this is glory. This is glorifying God. This is worshiping him for who he is. And Isaiah is pointing out the size of God. Like, we think about these things that happen, but we're missing the size, the scale and scope of God. And he uses these really wonderful images and metaphors, things like measuring the sky. You know, if you had a measuring tape, you can measure the sky, or if you count all the grains of sand or all the pieces of dirt in the world. I mean, God knows all of that. You know, to talk about knowing the hairs on our head, I make it easy on him, but they talk about knowing he has counted the hairs on your head. I mean, if he knows every hair, the point of that concept is, if he knows every hair on everybody's head and the number of them. So we have trouble getting our head around infinite, the concept of infinite. But God's infinite, which means he has infinite knowledge. And so he can know every tiny detail, every cell in your body, every hair on your head, every grain of sand. He's got counted. He knows. So we look at a beach and we see a beach. He looks at a beach and sees 574,495 grains of sand or whatever, like all the details of every little tiny crab and their lifespan and everything else about everything in that. Every time the water laps up, every single thing that's in the water, it's this infinite like mind that we can't even approach. And Isaiah's like, if we can get our head around a piece of that. You know, I've told this story before, but I came on the line one night, and one of my cooks was his name was Tom, and he became a missionary later in Latin countries. He's fluent in Spanish now, and he was praying on the line. And I'm like, Tom, why are you praying? He's like, I just want to pray for a good service. And I was his mentor, right, and his teacher, but he was about to teach me something big. And God just used him at that moment. And I'm like, why? Everything's fine. We're not having any emergencies. He's like, you don't have to pray when there's an emergency. You pray all the time for everything. God's got every little tiny thing. And I basically said, cool, and we prayed. But I thought to myself later how true that was. I should be praying for everything, like my toothbrush bristles to be pointing the right direction. Right? You know what I mean? Like, it's everything. And it's not like, I used to think of saving my prayers because I want to go to God with only important stuff. But he's infinite. It's not like he's sitting there like, you got 74 prayers, make them good. Right? You know, you're on 73 right now. You got like one more. And, you know, it's not like that. It's literally infinite. He's literally infinite. You can go to him infinite times. And that's hard for us to understand. You can't go to the bank infinite times. You can't go to your friend and ask for a dollar infinite times. I mean, there's nothing you can do infinity times except for God. So it's just like, wow. And it kind of shocked me into a new way of thinking about prayer as for everything every day, basically, you know. So it changed my, you know, kind of changed my pathway in a way. This is a while ago, but, you know, God decided it was time to use Tom like that. It was awesome. But this is kind of what this is about. And then it kind of, he's trying to bring in the focus on who God is. So in 15, behold, the nations are a drop in a bucket. And I'm not sure, but I really literally think this is where a drop in a bucket comes from. That whole concept of just a drop in a bucket. I literally think this is where it comes from. Right here in Isaiah. Because we got from 40 to 66, it's like quotes for posters. Like the whole, there's so many things that we've seen on a bumper sticker or t-shirt or in a church coming out of this because there's just wisdom after wisdom. I think of it like this, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I think of it like this. Isaiah, after the big battle, after everybody goes away and before the next problem, he spends the rest of his life just talking about the greatness of God and the coming Messiah and how big a deal everything is. Like he's got it. He had it anyway, but now he really has it. Like he's like, okay, you guys saw that. This is, look at this. I'm going to give you my best shot at who God is. Here we go, right? And I'm going to spend the next few years doing that. But the nations are a drop in the bucket and are counted as the small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beast sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing. So, and this sounds a little harsh, but he's trying to get at the scale of God. So, like, if you had scales, so if God had a pair of scales sitting in front of him, universal size scales, the whole earth, the whole history of everything that we've ever known or will know is like a piece of dust on the scale. It's not even stuff being put on the scale. It's like a piece of dust on the scale, you know? And if you think about the earth and the whole history of humans being a thing that you go, and then you start doing other real stuff, you know, it kind of, and you're like down on that speck of dust is, you know, everything from Adam, you know, and then, you know, Caesar or whatever is like a little tiny piece of a tiny piece of speck of dust on a speck of dust. You know what I mean? It like starts to put it in perspective. And the fact that, and the thing that gets us, and the thing he's getting to in a lot of ways, is that God that he's describing here will still take the time to make sure your toothbrush bristles are pointing in the right direction. That's totally crazy. What we believe is totally crazy. Because God is so big, but he actually cares. Like he'll actually give me a better parking place. Like it literally makes no sense. But he's got that much power, and he's that infinite, and he puts things in movement by the billions every second of every day from the beginning. He's put moving parts in place. So there is a thing where this bird was born, and then it had another bird, and then that bird had another bird, and then that bird decided to fly beside a road, and then a dog that was going to go out in the street saw that bird and temporarily stopped, and then I went by him and didn't hit him. Like every all crazy detail by the billions. And that only happens at that second in time with all that backup of all those birds and dogs being born for that. You know, I don't have hair because my brain gets inside my head when I think about this stuff and just knocks all the hair out. It's just like, what? But that's what he's doing. He's trying to give them this. To whom will you liken God? So how are we supposed to understand, you know, or what likeness will you compare him? Like, how are we supposed to describe this? The workman molds an image. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold. The silversmith casts silver chains. Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. How have you not known? How have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall the stalk take root in the earth. And when he also blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I appear? Shall I be equal, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number, who calls them by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, Not one is missing. I love this chapter. I mean, it's so hard to really understand, but you get this flavor for who God is. It's like if you think about a human doing something, but then you try to step back into the realm of understanding God, it's like this. Like a human is carving a carving. They're doing a great job carving a carving, and they've got this great talent. But then you stop and you pull back and you start thinking about things like the wood that they're carving and where does it come from and who built the tree and the knife that they're using to carve. It has metal in it, and the metal comes from the earth, had to be extracted, had to be melted down. Now you've got fire. What is fire and where does it come from? And who assembles the knife? And you got all these things going into this. And then there's the person's brain and the ability to actually do it. And there's a million God things happen to get this guy painting or carving or doing whatever. And it's like he's doing something that we're paying attention to. But if we step back, we're like, we see thousands of lines from God making all of that thing possible. And in the end, all God has to do is pull one of those lines and it just disappears because there wouldn't be any wood. Not, maybe it's not that piece, or maybe it's not that tree, or maybe it's all trees don't exist. Start thinking about that. It's just like, you know, that's why for me, like a concept like the basic concept of something like evolution isn't a problem for me. And the reason is God's just that complicated anyway. He could do whatever. He could set something into motion a billion years ago that turns into a tiger. I don't have a problem with that. God does what he wants to do. If he wants to set up a system where he designs stuff that comes out of muck and turns into other things, he could do whatever he wants. I'm looking at pages of a book that are made from paper. And I'm just, if I start thinking about that and everything that went into the fact that I have this in my hand, it blows my mind. I've got paper, I've got ink, I've got leather. There's a whole lifespan before that leather. It's crazy. So the idea that, you know, God would set things into motion over periods of time that we can't even comprehend is totally fine with me because God's doing everything I can't comprehend anyway. Like, is it 6 days or is it 600 billion years? I don't know. Probably, I don't even. God does what he wants to do. So I'm gonna call it. They're gonna call it a day in English, but for me, it's billion years. Okay, cool. I don't have a problem with that. God, you know, he can do whatever. He can do it in 6 seconds, or 6 trillion years. I don't know. I'm not trying to figure that out. I wasn't there. Like, you should definitely put Jupiter fifth. He's like, dude, I got this. You know, I wasn't there. You know, that's what I say stuff like that because that, one of the reasons I love science so much. When we look out there in the stars and we see crazy stuff, like I saw this incredible nebula picture the other day, and I'm just staring at that going, did God put all that stuff like that so that later on I would look at this picture and go, wow. I mean, that's billions of stars I'm looking at. Like, isn't that crazy? And I'm like, that does look like a horse head or whatever. What? That looks like, so there's a bunch of clouds of stars that looks like a horse head, but a horse head is a thing for a certain period of time in a certain place. Is that not crazy? That's what Isaiah is saying. I'm not as good as him, but that's what he's saying. So, so in 27, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. And my just claim is passed over by God. That's a pretty cool little sentence. Why do you think to yourself, your way is hidden from the Lord? So in light of everything we just said, you're supposed to go hide in the closet and do some shady stuff that God doesn't know. Is that how this is supposed to work? I mean, if you think about it like the way Isaiah is explaining, it's mind-boggling that anybody thinks they have a secret. Now, every person does think they have secrets. But imagine, this is the guy that knows all the hairs on your head. He knows the number of pieces of sand on a beach. And you're hiding what exactly? How are you doing that exactly? You're not, is the answer. You're not hiding anything from God. There's no such thing as hiding anything from God. It can't be done. So deal with it. What does that mean? Well, that means worship. That means deal with whatever it is. If you have a hurt in your heart or you're sneaking around doing something or whatever it is, you better solve it because God's not missing it. If God's on top of the every single crab's second leg, then he's not missing whatever it is you're thinking or doing. So deal with it. So that's he's preaching. Because if you heard that, you would be like, oh, you're right. I can't hide anything from God, obviously. So therefore, that's in the light. Therefore, I need to deal with it or whatever, right? No matter what it is. So they said, why do you think my way is hidden from the Lord? It's so funny. My just claim is passed over by God. Excuse me. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, never faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Now, this is your carving above the church door for the day. You're going to get them almost every chapter from now on. Yeah, this is a big one. And here it is. And the way he works his way toward that revelation is the coolest thing. Because working his way toward it, he's saying, this is who God is. And then God is taking care of us. And have you not known this? Because the reason he asked it like that, in that phrasing, have you not known, like known is past tense. You know, have you not known, have you not heard? The reason he's asking like that is because you have. No matter who you are, even if you're an atheist guy that's running, and I watched this guy the other day running his little atheist pony show, and I was like, have you not heard? Because he just denies. He doesn't like the idea of God. He doesn't like the idea of Christians. He's got an anti-Christian league, you know, that he runs, and he thinks that's really cool, you know, whatever. God's not worried about that, by the way. He's not sitting there. God's not staying up late at night worried about the atheist movement, okay? That's not a thing. But it's just so strange to me because every person can feel it. If they were to stop and clarify their life, like purify their mind, they would come to that. They would hear it. It's the universe is echoing it. You don't look at, you know, the universe and go, wow, that's a neat trick that magically appeared and had nobody behind it. And it just happens to be perfect. And we happen to be this exact distance from the sun and spin at this exact speed. And any little tiny thing out of about 4,000 things changed a little tiny bit, we would wink out of existence. But I'm sure glad that randomly happened, completely randomly like that. Nobody can do that logically. That doesn't logically track. So when you're doing something completely illogical, right? Like, let's say you consider another race to be not human, right? That's an illogical train of thought. You have to create an entire sort of opera in your mind to convince and change yourself into understanding this thing, right? That's wrong. If you let it all go and you just breathe out and quiet yourself, you could hear it. Like the universe is ringing. The universe is ringing with God. Like he's in everything. You can't just go, oh, there's, you can go, la, 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 like all you want, which is these guys, like, I can't hear you. That's okay. Kids do that. You know, we're all God's kids, and some of his kids are bad, right? They don't listen, right? But, you know, if you just listen, you would hear it. I think that have you not known, have you not heard is because everybody has. They may have denied it. They may have run away from it, but they do know that this is God, that this is the creator of the ends of the earth, that it doesn't make any sense. You don't walk along the beach and find a pocket watch in the sand and pull the pocket watch up and look at it and go, that is so cool how the waves and the rocks all hit each other randomly for so long and made this thing. That is so cool. What you do is immediately go, I wonder who lost a pocket watch. Where was this made? Who made this wonderful thing that tells time? Like, oh, a guy in Switzerland at a factory made this. That's kind of cool. You don't think it randomly happened. And that watch is not anything as complex as the human body or the earth or the seasons or the universe. You don't look at the universe and everything and go, that is so cool. It randomly fell like that. That is awesome. But people do. They're like, that's the only way around this whole God thing. Okay, we can't possibly have a God. Why do they not want a God? Well, because they would have a boss then. They want to be independent. They want to be free, you know, to do what they want to do. So you have to get rid of this God idea. Because if God's around, I got to do things his way. Because if he's real and he really created everything, he's going to put a path out for me. I'm going to have to figure that out, try to be on it. Man, that's really a lot of work. I think I should just go over here and teach a class in, you know, molecular biology and not worry about God or whatever. But you know, in the middle of the night, if you have a crazy nightmare or somebody tries to break in your house, what do? You start praying. Like most atheists pray under pressure. Like, why would the guy that's been leading the Atheist League for 24 years start crying out to God when the machine gun guys are kicking the door in? Because he can feel it in his heart. He always has. He just denied it and came up with a good argument against it. You know, it's a rare guy that in the position of being under complete attack doesn't call out to God, doesn't turn his mind and heart around at the last minute, even though he will deny it later. Like when those guys leave, he's like, see, there was no God because of blah, 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 or whatever. All right. But this turns into what he does. So he is there. And those who understand that, which are called those who wait on the Lord here, they're not going to. So if somebody is running a race, and they're running a race in their own power, they're going to run out of steam. But God, if they're running the race with God batteries, they don't go bad. God's the Energizer Bunny. They don't. It doesn't ever go bad. You're like, bang, 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 forever. People ask me this all the time. I do a lot of stuff, and it's a lot of hours and a lot of weird things, and I seem to be highly energized, and I have been for 50 years, and sometimes it doesn't make any sense. Sometimes it's back to back to back to back, and they're like, how are you doing this? I'm like, because it's not my batteries. I have universal batteries. God is running this thing. If he needs me to go take a nap, he'll put me to sleep. If he wants me to wake up and go run a race, I will. You know, as long as I'm living like that the best I can, he'll keep powering it. I got to get up and I got to go do this. And I'm so tired. And God will just be like, here we go, you know. And it happens all the time. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. And then just because he's poetic and it's beautiful, it's not just that, giving power to the weak and increasing your strength and helping you not grow weary. But not only that, you will mount up with wings like eagles, run and not grow weary, walk and not faint. So this imagery is strength beyond yourself. You don't have the ability to run and not grow weary. I can't run to the sanctuary and not be weary. Okay. I mean, my wife tried to run last night. She used to just take off and run. She used to be a runner, right? And she would run miles and miles and miles. And last night she decided she was going to take off and run. And she got like to the top of this hill and she like sat down against the wall. Like, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. Like, it's called 8,000 feet and over 40, you know? But anyway, she's like, I can't do that anymore. I'm like, well, I mean, when things happen, I can't, you know, do the stuff I used to do. But when the time came, God would change that. If she's chasing after a car that they had kidnapped her daughter, suddenly she's running 10 miles, you know, straight behind a car. And everybody's like, that lady was running, right? That guy picked the car up. Well, that's because his kid was trapped under. You can't pick a car up. Well, you can if God says you can. You know, this stuff happens all the time, you know. But so it's not only keeping you going in times of sorrow and trouble, but also giving you strength and power exceeding your abilities when it's needed. You know, the ability to preach to a million people for 10 straight hours, stuff that humans couldn't do, but God said it's time to save Nairobi. So that's what we're doing, or whatever. So that passage is one of, like you said, one of my favorite passages in Scripture. But yeah, this is how you renew your strength. You go to God. You realize who He is. Have you not heard? Have you not seen? Have you not known? Yes, you have. Realize it, meditate on it, and your strength will be renewed. You know what God is capable of. You've seen it. Even if you haven't, even if you're young and haven't seen it, you've heard about it. You feel it inside. You know it exists. That's why I love like youth, like YWAM, Youth with a Mission, groups of people that are young, and they haven't seen all this stuff, but God always lines up miracles for them to see. And I mean, I must have seen 20, 30 classes myself. There's been thousands of classes go through YWAM, but I must have seen 20 or 30 classes myself. Completely random people. So God will put together 40 people. They'll come from all over. They're all 18 to 21. They come from all over America. And He'll just assemble them. And it happens all the time, like thousands of times a year where He does this. And it'll blow your mind to just watch it because they're coming from everywhere. And nobody knows each other. They're coming from completely different backgrounds, but they all have one thing in common, and that's Jesus. That is, every place they came from, every church, every home had that belief and understanding. And then they bring these people together and they start working on stuff and getting ready. What they're getting ready for is to go to a foreign country in a very bizarre circumstance, in some cases dangerous, and talk about Jesus. And do that in a culturally sensitive way that doesn't offend anybody or get anybody thrown in prison or shot, if they can help it, although that happens. And you're training these people, but you're doing this by the thousands of groups in the thousand bases. It's mind-boggling. And I talk to these people all the time. And like I talked to this one young lady a few years ago. And I said, so where are you going? What's going on? And she said, well, the group that I got, because we were praying really hard to go to somewhere really, really, really bad. And I was like, why? Like, well, we felt like, I've been feeling like this since I was born, like my entire life. She was 18, 19. My entire life, I felt like I had to be a missionary, and then I had to do it in a very dangerous, scary place. And it turned out that my whole group was like that, that they'd all been having those dreams since they were babies. I'm like, really? She's like, yeah, they got Beirut as a youth group. Hey guys, we were in Colorado Springs, you know, having really cool chicken strips, but now we're going to be in Beirut. So I was like, well, how's that going? She said, I keep moving. We haven't left yet. Because that's why I was talking to her, because everybody else had been leaving. And she said, we haven't left yet because they keep changing our location because they keep getting bombed. Like, the locations keep getting blown up and everybody keeps getting killed. So they're trying to keep changing where we're going. And I'm like, and you're cool with that? And she's like, why wouldn't I be cool with that? I'm like, I like this. I like this a lot. So I said, so they're going to come up with your safe house. It's going to be long enough that it's going to exist that you get there. And then you're going to do what? She said, I'm going to figure it out on the ground, but we're going to talk about Jesus to everybody that'll listen. And they may shoot you. She's like, yes, they may shoot us. And you're cool with that. Absolutely. All right. And she said, and then she came and said, we got one. We're leaving tomorrow. It was like that. It's like a special forces op. It's like, we got one. We're leaving tomorrow. And I said, well, you're awesome. And we've become pretty good friends, because she was working in the coffee shop right beside my office. So we're like really good friends. And she said, I don't feel like there's a chance you're going to see me again. And I said, why? She said, I don't know if I'll be staying or I'll be killed, but I don't think we're ever going to see each other again. And I've been a little prophetic for most of my life. And I said, well, I hope we do see each other again. If not, God bless you and have a great time. And she left, and that was 7 years ago. I've never seen her again. She's gone. I don't know. I don't know if she's dead or if she just stayed. She might have inundated herself into society in the Middle East somewhere, but that was her thing. Dangerous Middle Eastern mission was her calling from birth. She knew it for 18 straight years and could not wait to get there, no matter what it looked like. And I was just blown away. You'll see groups put together like that at random. And God does these absolutely crazy things. They have a thing in YWAM where you have to, everybody comes there with baggage because they're humans and they're teenagers, okay? So they all come with stuff to work on. And one of the things they do is work on their stuff, because you can't go do what you're about to do and be heavily laden with some nonsense from your high school, right? Where you were abused by somebody or you abused somebody or whatever it was. You've got to get all that gone so you can be focused on only one thing, or you will miss something and be harmed, right? So they go through this whole purification process. One of the things they do is everybody has stuff. They have this day where everybody has to come up with the thing that they value the most. Usually it's their cell phone or their car or their computer, but it's the thing, not spiritually, the physical thing that they really can't live without, that it is important to them. And then they have to give it away. And so everybody prays until God tells them what it is and what to do with it. This is an actual thing that happens in every class. And so Jenny's over in the corner praying. She's got this really awesome new phone that she loves. She uses it to communicate with all of her friends. It's her most important possession that she has. And Johnny's over in this corner, and he's thinking about his dirt bike or whatever. He doesn't have a phone, and he doesn't communicate with anybody because he doesn't have much of a family or whatever. And then God tells Jenny, you're giving your phone to Johnny. And she gets up and walks across the room and hands it to Johnny and gives him the codes and says, it's yours, and walks away from it. And then he now has a phone. So now he reaches out to his dad, who he's never hasn't talked to in years because he doesn't have a phone. And his dad moves around a lot, but now he has a phone, and now he calls his dad, and now they heal their relationship. And this all happens in one room. And then Samantha is going to need to go back home, because it's something she's going to have to solve with her grandma, because when she's overseas, her grandma's going to die, but only God knows that. So she has to get home. Well, Cynthia has a car, and she's so proud of her car. It's really nice. She has a little pink fuzzy thing, and it's beautiful. And God says, give her the car. She gets up, walks across, and hands her the keys, and that's it. It's your car. A car can't give me a car. She's like, God said, give you the car. I don't want to, don't talk to me about getting this car back. God just told me, give you the car. I'm going to go over here and hope I get pants. Anyway, but the point is, you're like, you don't have pants on today, do you? Anyway, I mean, I've seen people do that, pull off jackets. Like, I've got a really, really nice leather jacket. That's what God said. Not anymore. He goes over, gives it to the kid who doesn't have a jacket, and he's about to be, you know, in a broken down van in a snowstorm. And so God does this literally every class, multiple classes a year, 1,000 bases, multiple classes a year. He does this every single time because this is when he shows everybody who he is. Like, they mostly know a little bit about who he is, but this is him getting real specific. You're going to need to give that person this thing, and that person's going to do that with it, and that person's going to do that with it, and it's all going to be, and everything comes together. And by the time it's all over, a couple weeks later, everybody's like, they all see it. They see it all unfold. And it's mind-boggling. But it's an example of who God is. And so all these things about the youths or about all this, for me, it's like this section of Isaiah where God is actively showing people who he is or what he'll do. And then after all of that, not only have you broken a tie with something you were connected to that you didn't need to be connected to, but someone else has been blessed by that. It's totally random. People, sometimes it's money. Somebody has like a satchel of money hiding under their thing, and they've got all this extra money because they have a pretty wealthy family. And so they've scrolled away this extra couple thousand just in case. And God's like, nope. You're going to take that little waist belt thing full of cash and hand it to Sam. And you walk across the thing. It's like, what is this? It's a giant pile of cash. I really thought I needed it. God said, I don't need it. In fact, he wants me to have $0. So I'm going to go with zero. And we're going to see what happens because I can't even buy a candy bar. So God's going to have to give me a candy bar. And that happens all the time. All the time. And it blows people's minds. And then they know, because then when something happens later, when God's going to move, they're going to believe in his movement because they've seen it already. So they'll have like one of the groups, they have accidents happen all the time. Crazy crap happens. You're all going into foreign countries. You're riding a public bus that turns over, or your helicopter wrecks. I had this race when I broke my ankle. Two of us broke our ankle on the same day. One was me here in Colorado Springs with the best orthopedic surgeon in the world living right there. He is the head doctor for the Paralympics, and he's in Woodland Park, Mesner. I had one of the greatest surgeons in the world, nothing but modern technology. She broke her ankle because her helicopter crashed coming in for a landing in Nepal. And she fell off the side of the helicopter, hit the ground, and broke her ankle in the same way. She got rusty screws put into her ankle that cracked the bones from a village doctor with a screwdriver. She got back home, medevaced back here eventually. And we were beside each other together, healing. And she had the worst doctors in the world. And I had the best doctors in the world. And we had the same time frame. And she said, you want a race? I said, race to what? And she said, to fully healed. Because your comfort level, you're a believer and you're going to be fine. But your comfort level has got you in a different position. I guarantee you that God heals me faster and better. I said, how are you that confident? She's like, because who gets a rusty screw put in their ankle when they're on a mission for God? He has a plan. And the plan is he's going to use that to show off. He's going to show people his power. He's going to overcome all that nonsense and put me back on my feet running in record time. And he's going to do it for his glory, because we're all going to understand it was him. The reason for the rusty screw is that That's humans. I'm going to prove he's going to overwhelm all of that. And I'm like, you know that. She's like, yeah, I felt that when I started to fall. I felt the healing start to happen before I was injured. I said, I don't want to raise you. and she had to go back through surgery. It was like a month later. They pull out all the old crap. This guy's got like rusty crap in her leg. They pull it all out, reconstruct everything. She's a month behind me. She's way ahead of me. She's walking around. I'm still on crutches. She's like, how's his crutches? God's healing me too. She's like, he just needs me running out there quicker because he needs me back in the field. And it turns out that the timing was there was another trip to the same location coming up, and she had to be fully healed. So she had to be healed a month or two faster than normal, even with a month or two behind schedule. So 4 times faster than normal, so how fast she had to be healed, because she'd be back on another helicopter going back to the same village. And she shows up in the same village on the next flight. They're like, what just happened? Like, I'm back, you know, and I'm still in my little thing going. But God had me doing stuff too. The reason for my ankle break was to write a book. He told me, I need you to write a mission kitchen guide for all the people training as chefs in the missionary kitchens around the world. And I said, Lord, this is the last time I argued with God. This is like, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago. I try not to argue anymore. He said, no, I need you to write this book. And I said, no, God, I'm too busy. Got all this stuff going on. I'm running around all the time. He said, okay. I go down these icy steps. I do that little Russian dance move where they spin down and pop back up, except I didn't pop back up. And I'm laying in the snow screaming. And then I get the surgery and everything. Now I'm on the couch with my computer, and I'm like, they're like 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm like, oh, just enough time to write a book. Anyway, so I wrote a book, and then I was back to normal. And my ankle's actually stronger than it was before that. But anyway, so he was making a point with both of us. And then the interaction we had has us both telling that story for the next 25 years about how we were racing. Because she was in so much worse shape than me at the beginning. I'm like, that's hardly fair. And she's like, we'll see. And then she's so much better shape than me a couple of months later. I'm like, what is happening right now? She's like, every morning we wake up and the prayer group lays their hands on my ankle. I'm like, can I come? Anyway, yeah, it's a true story. Anyway, let's pray. Sorry, I just rambled a lot. Lord, thank you so much for this day and this group and this ability to come together. We are so grateful to be able to look into your word and to learn from it and to be refreshed, to be renewed in our strength and our spirit, just like the word says. We're so grateful. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for this day, and it's so beautiful, wonderful. Keep everybody safe, the folks that aren't here or traveling around back and forth. Keep everyone safe. Protect our health and our homes and our businesses. Just draw us closer to you. Bless the sermon today. I think Pastor Manny is preaching today. But bless the pastors and protect the pastors. Bless the sermon and all of our leaders, and keep us coming closer and closer to you and getting our feet more and more on your path. We want more of you all the time. Have your way in our lives. And thank you, thank you, thank you for this day. Bring us back together again for more of a chance to study your word and draw closer to you. We love you so much. We pray all these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.